Hey everybody, welcome to the Company Forensics podcast, named after a very successful YouTube series. So in this podcast, we hear forensic stories from the founders themselves. And our guest today is Mike Lingle. The story of how I met Mike is quite peculiar. His previous company, Slab Rocket, was one of the success stories that for presentation startups that we would reference in our own pitch deck when we started Slidebean. And I remember distinctly how the Slab Rocket exit was a selling point for our investors for Slidebean. And then that company was acquired. Mike went on to fill a bunch of roles in the startup world. He was senior vice president of sales at Custom Show, who was one of our competitors. He's now head of, or acting head of product at Velocia. And he was also an entrepreneur in residence at Boston College. So, you know, lived in the entrepreneur world for a lot longer than I have. His co-founder, this is a funny note, his co-founder at Slab Rocket went on to found Beautiful AI, who is another one of our very direct competitors these days. So this is a very curious experience for me, especially getting to talk to somebody so close to our space, but curiously enough, not a direct competitor for the moment. And today I want you all to hear Mike's story from his own mouth on, you know, on selling his company, on spending so many years in the startup world, and to talk a little bit about the opportunities that we can still create in a crowded market. So Mike, it is a pleasure to have you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me here. And, you know, likewise, I've been watching, you know, I'm always curious about the presentation space, and I have been watching the evolution of Slidebean. I work with a lot of startups, so I see Slidebean presentations come across my desk. You definitely have a fanatical user base. So it's great. It's great to connect.
Cool. Thanks for being in the podcast, Mike. I want to, you know, we're going to make a really cool video episode out of this. Maybe if people are watching, they've already watched that episode on YouTube, but I want to start with the Slab Rocket story. There are probably some parallels between yours and mine, but how did the inspiration to go out and compete against PowerPoint and Prezi, where did that come
from? So I had actually, when we launched Slab Rocket, I had already been working in the presentation space for like 10 years. And the short story is, I was a software developer, like a multimedia developer, and got hired by big companies to do product launches for them. So I did big things for like Colgate. One year I did a kiosk for IBM that like traveled around with the Olympic torch. Like I would do all these cool one-off projects. And eventually that led to me getting hired by the Discovery Channel to build presentations for them to go sell ad space. So when you turn on Discovery and see the ads, they wanted to sell the presentations with something that looked like television, but was editable like PowerPoint. And the killer feature was that they wanted to be able to control all of the content from a marketing person's desk. So as the programs changed, as the research changed, as the pricing changed, they wanted to have this library of slides. They make the change in one place, they push a button, and it updates on every salesperson's laptop across the company. With the footnote that this was before the internet was really a thing. I have gray hair. So that was actually a real challenge. You didn't have the cloud at that point. So we started doing it on CD-ROMs. So they would like mail CD-ROMs to salespeople for them to like put in their laptops. And then eventually we started using the corporate WAN sort of behind the corporate network behind the firewall. And then what Slab Rocket was 10 years later. So we sold this to Discovery. Discovery loved it. And I turned around and sold it to every other cable network, every magazine, everyone I could find. So CNN, TBS, TNT, Cartoon Network, Fox, USA, Sci-Fi, Bravo. And so Slab Rocket was kind of the next generation of that. So we already had the customer base. And I started talking to Mitch, who's now the beautiful.ai guy, who was the guy who had started me doing multimedia programming. So we sort of came full circle and we were like, okay, let's start this company together. And the idea was to take what we already had, what I already had, and move it to the cloud. And by this point, the internet was a thing. So we were using an early version of Amazon Web Services. You know, we started working on this in like 2006, 2007. Mitch was a crazy good full stack developer. We were using Flash, like, you know, Flash had just come out, and Adobe Flex, which was like super Flash. Uh-huh. Mitch was just crazy good at that. So he was able to move a lot of what I had already built offline, online into the cloud, and we launched it as Slab Rocket. So it was one of those instant success stories that took over a decade.
So two things I want to highlight here, because I think they relate a lot to a lot of the founders that we talked to, to their stories. So you identified this from your own work. You know, yeah. You identified this problem, this need from your own work. When did capital come into this thing?
So it didn't in the first 10 years. And that's kind of the footnote. I do a lot of work with people on financial modeling now. And so I didn't raise any money the first time around. So I had a company, we had all these big media companies as clients. We actually didn't raise money. I tried to get some of those clients, like I tried to get Turner Broadcasting, which is CNN, TBS, TNT, Cartoon Network. They were a big customer of ours. I tried to get them and I tried to get NBC at the time to invest. They weren't really set up for venture at that point. You know, these days it would be a little bit easier. And I couldn't get them to invest. I didn't raise money. And then we were just doing so well that I was able to hire and build and everything was kind of rolling. And then the dot-com crash hit, which hit not only tech, but it hit media. And all of a sudden our company went from being in good shape to all of a sudden none of those customers were paying. So they all owed us money, but they were all delaying payments. And no one was buying anything new. So we had this horrible moment where I realized I had mismanaged the finances and we had to lay some people off, which was still like one of the worst moments in my career. Like, you know, you make this promise to people when you hire them that you're going to take care of them. We ended up not doing that. We couldn't raise money in that environment. Fast forward, that's now why I'm so focused on financial projections. Like, how do I help entrepreneurs avoid the mistakes that I made? But it was during that environment when I was building that company back up. So I brought it back from the brink, kept a bunch of the great customers, the market started working again. And, you know, a few years later, I was talking to Mitch, and that's when we decided to move the whole thing to the cloud. And that eventually became the new company. And that was the company where we brought in capital. So we raised a $2 million Series A, partly because of the awesome work that Mitch had done. Like, again, he was just a crazy good full stack developer. And partly because I had this customer base. So we could put the VC firms on the phone with HBO and Sony and NBC. And they were just, you know, raving about how good the existing software was and how, you know, they basically replaced PowerPoint for their sales and marketing teams. And so that combination was what unlocked the capital for us.
How specific was this product for this audience, for the studios? You know, could somebody else take it? Could a marketing agency take it? Or what features did it have that were specific to them?
Short answer is anyone could use it. And that actually became a point of friction as we grew the company. What SlideRocket was the single best slide editing and management environment I have ever seen, even to this day, 10 years later.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Like no one, like it was deep. I have seen some great slide editing environments and I don't mean to disparage SlideBeam. Like SlideBeam works incredibly well. We had all kinds of extra features about, like that library management piece turned into a big piece. You had this like reach and control and granularity that's really useful when you're working in groups, right? Or working in teams. We did have all kinds of small agencies. And what was cool for the small agencies is they could manage multiple clients and do the same thing where they could control the core content and then open up pieces of it to the clients to customize. And then the client could then open up that library to their salespeople. So you could have like layers of people stacked managing the slide content. Plus it was a really good Flash editor. So Flash's editing tools were pretty awesome. Even now, a lot of it has been recreated in HTML5, but with Flash you had some additional stuff because it was a plugin within the browser. But it's been mothballed and no one's ever tried to build anything that comprehensive again. But anyone could use it. And so that actually became a point of friction because we had these giant customers who were expecting us to build this thing, especially once we had been funded. But it became very useful for smaller organizations. Schools were using it, like a lot of schools were using it. And actually the whole strategy started to shift towards more of a consumer focus than a B2B focus, which was, I mean, it all worked out, but it was painful at the time, especially for me, because I had promised, you know, these big companies that we were building this thing for them and for the big companies who were hanging around waiting for this thing to come to fruition. And all of a sudden we were kind of changing strategy.
they're not our customers anymore. 3 years ago, I would have asked this question to write in my notebook and go do it myself. But how do you get in front of that decision maker at HBO?
Well, the key thing was having the first client. So once I had Discovery, I could get meetings with every other cable network with, you know, just saying, look, we've already done this for Discovery. Can I come in and talk to you about it? Right? Because that's what really opened the door. And then once I had a couple television networks, cable networks, I could go to the magazines because they were also in media. They were also doing ad sales. And then from there, I started looking at, okay, we're in New York. You know, who's in New York? And started branching out. So we did some financial services companies. We did some beauty companies, like Redken was a customer of ours for a long time. So I just started, you know, branching out. But it was always a challenge to get that first one in an industry, and then you could expand from there.
What was peak SlideRocket? You know, I don't know if you can share it, but your biggest year in terms of revenue or in terms of team size, like what was peak SlideRocket? And was that the point in which exit discussions started happening?
So SlideRocket raised a second round of $5 million. And then as part of that, we brought in a CEO who was a Salesforce executive who turned out to be awesome. And he got the company sold in less than a year and a half. So part of the answer to your question is working with the VCs to get the right management team in who were focused on growth and selling the company, right? As opposed to us as the founders, were maybe not as focused on those things. And the way the company got bought was not based on sales or revenue. So what happened is at VMware, a Microsoft executive joined VMware and had this whole vision for cloud, right? And VMware didn't necessarily have a cloud strategy at the time. And so the idea was, you know, VMware is business facing. Where do business people spend most of their time? They spend most of their time in email and they spend most of their time making presentations. So VMware's strategy was to purchase a presentation company, a cloud-based presentation company, and to purchase a cloud-based email company. And between our VCs and the Salesforce guy, they knew people at VMware and were able to insert us into that conversation as the candidate for the presentation company. At the same time, SlideRocket was working on raising a third round, and that became key to the negotiation because what this guy did that was genius, the SlideRocket CEO who had come in, was he played the VCs off of the potential acquirers. And so he would get, you know, a term sheet from the acquirer and go over to the VCs and say, look, you know, we want to do this third round with you, but we have this deal from this acquirer. Can you make the, you know, we can't do it unless you make the terms a little better. And so he would get better terms from the VC and then go back to the acquirer and say, look, we want to do this deal with you, but now these VCs are offering us these terms and we have to take this seriously. Can you, you know, make the terms better? And he did that several times. Like he was able to make that loop a few times and ended up, you know, we ended up getting bought for something that was completely out of whack with the financials at the time. So it ended up being like a good, you know, solid exit, but kudos to him for being an excellent negotiator.
How was that experience of hiring a CEO to replace you?
I was not the CEO at the time. So I was intentionally not being the CEO. I had been the CEO at my own presentation company for 10 years, and I was really hoping to learn something from someone else. So I intentionally kept myself out of that CEO role. So Mitch, the beautiful AI guy, became the CEO, and then this Salesforce guy came in, and it was all right. I think I still, even with the gray hair, I think in my career, I have not found a great CEO mentor who I've been able to really work with. And I think about that a bunch. Like I figured it out, right? But I figured it out through the School of Hard Knocks, not through like mentorship and modeling. And I do regret that at SlideRocket, I didn't really get to work with that CEO because I left right as he was coming in. So it all worked out in a cool way. But I think in a perfect world, I would have had a year or two, you know, working directly with that guy and picking up what he knew, because he clearly knew a lot.
So as part of this deal, VMware buying SlideRocket, were you part of the package, or did you leave the company at that point?
I was not part of the package. So they wrote me a check and I said, great. Yeah, I was not part of the package. And VMware actually didn't know, once they bought the company, they actually changed strategies and then weren't quite sure what to do with SlideRocket. P.S. SlideRocket still had a bunch of Fortune 500 customers. So some of those media companies were still using the product. So it was actually kind of a weird situation for VMware, because they didn't want to leave those companies hanging, because it was pretty important. Like, it was the sales functions of those companies that were using the product. And VMware obviously wanted good relationships with those organizations. So VMware changed strategy and ended up selling SlideRocket to a company called ClearSlide. That was big at the time, but it's kind of faded. I don't know if you ever hear about them. I used to hear about them all the time.
We
10 years ago.
All right, so how is this? Now I'm very curious about this, and this is I'm asking because I want to know. What's post exit life? What happens after you get a very fat check? What do you do? Do you take a break? Do you want to start something right away?
Yes. So I did not start my own company. I did find another presentation company that was a competitor. That was actually right up the street. They were based in New York City, also right up the street from where I lived, and worked with them for a while to try to get them VC funded and do it again, right? So rather than start my own, I tried to like accelerate someone else's. The problem I had was that it was a family-owned business, and they just culturally wouldn't make the jump to becoming a VC-funded company. I was making a good living, but there was no like rocket to it, if that makes sense. And then that for a few years, and it was fine. I had a great time with those guys and we built some really cool stuff, but it was never going to scale or grow the way I was looking for. And then I got a check from SlideRocket and I was like, you know, I'm just going to take a break. And I'm actually, the answer to your question is I'm a music guy. So I actually took a couple years off and just did music. I was DJing. I learned how to produce records. I was working with like singers and rappers, like producing tracks. I built a home recording studio. It was pretty awesome. Figuring that I would never have this opportunity in my life again, right? Because I was still like, I hadn't gotten married. I didn't have a house. I didn't have kids. And during that period, which lasted about two and a half years, I met my wife and we dated for like a year, and then she got a job transfer offer to Miami. So I was in New York at the time. She got a job transfer to Miami, and it was the only time in my career, like I hadn't been tethered anywhere. And I was like, great, let's go. So we ended up in Miami, and that's when I started plugging back into the tech community. So there's like a good startup scene here. I started mentoring. I've run a couple accelerator programs down here. I started creating content. I started seeing founders trip over a lot of stuff that I had tripped over. So I started creating videos and articles and lessons and tools, templates, which is where I started just seeing people trip over the financials all the time. And I know you're seeing that problem with the founders you work with too. So then it became a pet project of mine. Okay, how do I get people to understand, not just get them the good financials, but get them to understand what the heck they're doing in the financials, right? So that's what it is. It's a break and then getting super involved in the startup community and trying to help as many other people as I possibly can.
I'm curious because Mitch, your co-founder, went on to create our next competitor. And then I'm curious as to, do you have any idea why he would stay around the presentation space? I don't know if I would build another presentation company when we sell SlideBeat. Yeah. Was there another opportunity untapped, you feel?
I can't speak for Mitch. I don't know what his thought process was. I had the same thought process as you. I mean, SlideRocket was my third or fourth presentation company. And then, I also went to another presentation company after. So like I have done the presentation thing. I don't have any desire to go back into that world unless something changes. I mean, but I agree with you. Like I would do something else. I cannot speak to his motivation.
What stuff gets easier the second time around? I know that you didn't start as well. You started another presentation company, but does getting a job get easier? Does raising money from investors get easier after you have an exit under your belt?
I think raising money from investors gets easier. That whole process is kind of demystified. And I think it's more clear why one raises money. You know, I work with a lot of early stage startups where the business plan is raising money. And I don't think that's really the answer. You know, I think you raise money once you know what you have and you need some money to grow. Like even with SlideRocket, you know, I had a functioning business, so we had customers. And we had built, Mitch had built a lot of functionality. So it worked really well. Like we weren't raising the money to build the thing. It was already functioning. Plus we had a wait list, right? So we already had thousands of people waiting to use this thing. So it was a pretty compelling package when we went to the investors. And I think, you know, we did a $2 million Series A. And, you know, when you're taking venture capital money, a couple things happen. One is you're putting yourself on a timeline. You're saying, you know, within 5 to 7 years, we want to either get acquired or IPO, right? And that's what the investors are looking for. That's why they're giving you the money. And two is, you know, you want someone to join the board who really can help you get there, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got, Hummer Winblad was our VC, and we got a guy who was awesome. You know, he had done this before with his own company. He had helped other companies who were in the portfolio do this. And, you know, he was a great source of advice and introductions. You know, they helped us find the Salesforce exec. Like the whole thing, it wasn't just about the money. It was about the path that, you know, you're stepping onto. But we did a lot of work ahead of time. So when we showed up for that, you know, to pitch them, we had a package. It wasn't just like, hey, we have this idea.
You touched on the board and then this concept of your, well, of course, there's a board of directors, and we get a few questions about that, about how to structure it, about in what function does it fulfill inside the business, but also on the advisory board. Let's maybe start with the board of directors. How did you structure the board meetings? Who was in your board besides the founders? How did that work?
Right. So really the boards work best when there are three people or five people, so that you don't have a deadlock. So three is usually the easiest to start with if you're early stage, but really it's, you know, the CEO of the company, the investor, and one independent board member. And I think we made a strategic error by not filling that independent board member seat. So we operated for a long time with just a board of two. And in retrospect, and you know, I was pushing to fill the independent board member seat, but in retrospect, I would try to fill that seat because the board is really a source of help, right, when done right. And I do wish we had had another person, especially my own pet peeve. We had a real difference of opinion on strategy, whether we were B2B or B2C, and it would have been nice to have someone else with some experience in there helping us navigate that situation.
Yeah, of course. What role did advisors play in the whole company story, and how did you compensate them? Because once again, we get this question a lot on, you know, what to get to advisors, how important are they, should they be on the pitch deck?
Right. It depends on who the advisor is. I can tell you my SlideRocket experience, but I also have helped so many companies think this through. My personal, you know, what I think works best for the board of advisors is aim high, right? I think you really want to find people who are in your space or a related space who have really knocked the ball out of the park. And you want to be able to, I mean, certainly you want to be able to put them on the pitch deck to help with the fundraising, but you also want to be able to talk to them, right? I think, you know, everything I'm saying about both the board of directors and the board of advisors, I think we function best when we surround ourselves with people who have been there, done that, and can give us real educated opinions. I think where we got into a little bit of trouble with SlideRocket on the board of advisors, well, on the board of directors, we didn't have that third person we could tap into. And then in the board of advisors, I don't think we aimed high enough, you know, and we didn't really use that to propel ourselves forward the way I've seen other companies do that.
Now, you've been doing financial models for a while. That's the reason why we connected originally. The way we got into financials was exactly that. We've been helping a bunch of startups with their pitch decks, and they have no idea how much money they need, or they don't know how to project them. And then we figured, well, maybe we'll give them our template and we'll give them a head start. And that has sort of unexpectedly become a new, whole new line of business for us. And we found a new opportunity there.
Congrats.
What's your experience with, or what errors do you usually see with startups and their financial projections?
I think there's a tendency for the entrepreneurs to be really good at the product or service and the vision. They are medium, many of them tend to be medium, but the customer and the market. A lot of times I see people building stuff for no one and they don't know who their customer is. And then many of them fall down when it comes to the financials. So I think the two problems startups, you know, really often need to focus on are customer and financials. And the financials piece is the one where I've ended up becoming obsessed. And again, I started my first company at 25, not understanding the finance piece at all. I was a good programmer. I was not a good manager and I didn't understand the numbers. And then I rebuilt myself as someone who does understand the numbers. And I saw the difference, right? Like with SlideRocket, I had become good enough that, you know, I built a lot of the financial model. And then once we raised the money, we used that financial model to run the business for the first year. Like it wasn't just smoke and mirrors. Here's something you investors need to see. It was like, it was real and we used it and it worked. And I think that's what, you know, that's what startups should really be shooting for. In my perfect world, I think the first mistake is not creating a financial model proactively. So what I see, and I'm sure you see this too, people create the financial model because they need to pitch investors. The investor pitch shouldn't be the trigger, but it is the trigger, right? But I think that's a mistake. One of the mistakes that is cracking me up this month. So three times this month, I have been dealing with entrepreneurs who want to supersize the projection. So they want to just blow out the revenue. And my reaction to that is, look, you want to be optimistic, but you don't want to make it so crazy that people think, you know, you're insane. No one will listen to me. And three times in a row, they've gone to pitch investors and the investors get freaked out by the size of the revenue projections. And I have not found a way to get people to listen to me other than to let them go pitch the investors. Then I get the phone call, like they thought our revenue projections were ridiculous and it was a red flag. And I'm like, great. I know. But then they're ready to talk and kind of dial things back down. So I think there's a fine line between being optimistic and being ridiculous.
We see a bunch of companies trying to solve this. And one of the discussions we've had coming, both of us coming from a story of trying to replace PowerPoint in a way, we see this in the financial model space now where a few companies, there's a YC company trying to do it, are trying to rebuild Excel or replace a traditional spreadsheet or Google Sheet or Excel for this. And we've been sort of agreeing that that's probably not the way to go because, you know, can you really replace Excel? And I wanted to have on record some of your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult to replace Excel. I think what you can do and what I've been playing with is, can you put an interface on top of Excel, right? To simplify it. Because I think part of my approach has been to solve the education piece along with the financial model piece. And I think a lot of companies are creating financial model tools, templates, like you can get a million templates on the internet, but I don't think they really connect and help you build the framework of like, why are you doing this? How are you doing this? What are the drivers? So I agree that there needs to be a dialing back of like when someone opens Excel and sees all those little boxes, like I watch their brains shut down, right? So there is a need to prevent that from happening. And then there's a second need, like in whatever you're doing needs to be flexible enough that it handles whatever business the entrepreneur is throwing at it. And that's a whole challenge. Again, in my perfect world, if we're dealing with early stage startups, there would be one business model, you get that right, and then you start expanding. What I get is people who want, you know, to combine different business models and mix and match this and do, it's a marketplace, but it's also a subscription. And we're also mailing out t-shirts, you know, like, which doesn't mean they can't do it. It's just, it's hard to get all those things right at the same time. And then it's hard to model it. I think there's a need to solve both of those problems, but recreating Excel is not the answer. As you said, like as people who have tried to recreate PowerPoint, recreating Excel is even more difficult than recreating PowerPoint.
Yeah, that's one of the details we've seen in these financial models that we've worked on for the past few months, which is, you know, there's a point in which even if it's built on a Google Sheet, we built it on a Google Sheet, you know, if once you have too many variables in there, it just becomes impossible to manage, right? So, you know, start simple. I think that a simple financial model that projects subscribers, churn, cost of acquisition can go a long way to understanding if your business is viable or not. Like I was in a talk with an entrepreneur the other day, and you know, they were looking to charge a 1% fee per transaction. And very clearly the financial model throws that, you know, unless you're billing hundreds of millions of dollars, that's not a lot of money.
Yeah, that's not enough.
Right?
Yeah.
Those are quick answers that hopefully a simple financial model can answer for people. But
correct.
So now the exciting part here is that Mike offered to join some of our office hours. So he's going to be offering office hours after we launch this podcast. I'm going to link Mike's link in the description and you'll be able to book him, speak about financials, exits, fundraising, and all the stuff that he's been through.
All the fun stuff.
Mike, I don't have any more questions. It's been amazing to have you.
This has actually been great. I've been wanting to connect with you for 10 years now. So it's great that we're finally connected and talking.
It was a curious experience to finally get to connect. And for me, like I've had these questions about the SlideBean story for 7 years since we started SlideBean, and you have just answered them for me.
That's great. And congratulations on all the great stuff you're doing with SlideBean, both on the presentation side and the financial modeling side. Like I've been watching and it's just cool to see the evolution and the growth, and congratulations on all the stuff you've accomplished.
Thanks for
following. It's fun when your startup is working, right?
Mike, thanks a lot for being with us today, and we'll have everybody see you at the office hours.
Awesome. Thanks so much.